You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm the Chief Executive of the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you here today. Now, considering the events of the week just gone, it seems we're all in urgent need of a field guide to lies, or alternative facts, perhaps. And we're very lucky to have Daniel Everton here as our expert guide. Daniel is an award-winning neuroscientist, musician, and author. He's the author of three best-selling books. This is Your Brain on Music, The World in Six Songs, and The Organized Mind. And he's also the James McGill Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Neuroscience at McGill University. I said to Daniel that I've been reading this book. It's an absolutely fantastic. And one of the things about this book is it's kind of, on the one hand, it exposes things that need to be exposed. On the other hand, I'm afraid it also teaches you how to misuse statistics, which is a slightly worrying thing. So I said to Daniel when he came in, I said, there's a very strong correlation between reading your book and falling asleep. But then I had to say to him that that's because I read it in bed, because that's the only time I get a chance to read. So that's an example of a bogus correlation, which is one of the ideas in the book. So I'm really looking forward to hearing from you. So please join me in welcoming Daniel Everton.
Well, thank you all for coming. I'm just delighted to be here. I'm here, as you heard, to talk about a new book, The Field Guide to Lies and Statistics. And I'm delighted to be here in particular because for the first time appearing here, I'm now a fellow of the RSA. And the RSA in particular and London readers in general have been really good to me and really supportive of my work. One of the interesting things is that I get these sales figures from my publisher, and Londoners, as a proportion of the population of the world, buy my book in much greater numbers than anyone else. Five times as many Londoners as people in the United States, for example. So it's thanks to you that I was able to write another book, and I appreciate that. I started working on the book in 2001, because I realized that as an educator, I was beginning to see a change in the college students who came to me, in that they seemed more willing to accept things that they discovered in the news and less willing to ask follow-up questions about whether they were true or not. Now, I don't know if you can think back to 2001, but it was a different political and media landscape back then, but that doesn't mean that there shouldn't have been questioning of authority or of facts. That's always a good thing. But it seemed that I felt like I wanted to write something to help the average person get through their day a little bit better, to be able to make decisions more quickly, to save time when decisions presented themselves by having a quick little list they could check off of what do I need to ask to make the right decision. To help people in school get better grades on their papers because they were actually following through with a question. And then I had some other books I wanted to write, and I did those, and then I started working on earnest on this in 2014. And I finished writing it in April of 2016, and I had no idea what would happen in the time since then. I just, not a clue. Between 2001 and 2016, things had changed. I had now seen 15 years' worth of students who came in less and less prepared to do college work. And I spent a lot of time talking to high school students, and they seemed less and less prepared. And it seems to me we failed an entire generation of students by not teaching them to think critically. I think schools took this out of their curriculum maybe because it sounded stuffy and old-fashioned. The very word, the words critical thinking just sound kind of archaic and not modern. And I actually prefer the term evidence-based thinking. Critical thinking comes with some baggage, as though it doesn't have to mean this, but it's as though it means that we don't value emotion and we don't value the arts, and it doesn't mean that at all. But, you know, evidence-based thinking, I think, is a more neutral term. And then, well, let's look at what's happened in the last 6 months. We've got this proliferation of fake news and alternative truth. And I never thought that anybody would utter this phrase, but in the last week we've heard of alternative facts. And I happen to think that words matter. If I go to my mechanic and he says, your car is safe now, but what he really means is the opposite, that's not an alternative fact or an alternative way of expressing the world. I mean, the car is either safe or it's not, to the best of his knowledge. And for that matter, it matters to me whether my mechanic is actually licensed and not under disciplinary action and, you know, not the subject of several lawsuits and things. I mean, these things, words matter. And I was particularly outraged when some major newspapers in the United States began writing about fake news and alternative news and alternative truth, because I felt that the journalists were invoking euphemisms out of a sense of misguided political correctness, not wanting to offend anybody. So, you know, you can't really call it for what it is. There's no such thing as fake news. It's a lie. It's either news or it's a lie, right? So, and the term fake news, it has this kind of, I guess, equivocal or mischievous quality, right? I mean, fake, like, it sounds too much like a kid faking sick to get out of a test at school. And, you know, there's nothing news about it if it's fake. And, you know, fake news is the side of a bus telling you that $350 million a week could be going into the NHS if you would vote for Brexit. Now, there may be perfectly good reasons to vote for Brexit or against it. This is not a political issue, right? Truth is not about politics. There shouldn't be a political party that is any more invested in the truth than another. The truth should be the basis on which we have a political discussion. Okay, these are the facts. What are we going to do about them? And reasonable people may disagree about what to do about the facts. Reasonable people may disagree about the steps to take to improve the economy, but at least you agree that the economy needs to be improved, right? When I became outraged, I did what a writer does. I wrote an op-ed lambasting the American media for using terms such as fake news. And I got it published in the New York Daily News, which is the fourth largest paper in the country. The first three didn't want to touch it. But the New York Daily News is still millions of readers. And what I said to the New York Daily News was, you are part of the problem. You're talking about fake news. Just call it a lie. And if you're afraid of offending somebody, if they're lying to you, I say offend them. Go ahead. They should be offended. Part of the problem is that we've become a bit too complacent, I think. We've sort of accepted a state of the world where, oh, well, politicians lie, nothing you can do about it. You're going to get cheated. People are going to take your money. If you're not careful, this guy will cheat you, and there's nothing you can do about it. I disagree. That kind of complacency undermines the bedrock of democracy, which is freedom of speech. And freedom of speech involves being able to have an independent press that's willing to stand up to people who are lying and to hold people accountable. So I think we have to. Do three things, as Barack Obama said in his exit speech. And again, I don't think this is political. It has nothing to do with whether you support Obama or not. I think part of critical thinking is that you don't ignore good advice just because it comes from somebody you may not like, right? And the opposite is also true. It happens a lot of people like Obama. But the advice he gave was that democracy is not free. And as a free society, many of us who live in democratic countries have begun to take it for granted, and we've allowed democracy to be the responsibility of other people. And Obama says as soon as you do that, you start losing the very thing that you cherish. It's up to all of us. Each of us is personally responsible for making sure that there's freedom of the press, for making sure that our legal systems are functioning properly and they're unbiased. In the most perfect of all worlds, you've got a legal system that is built, that is designed to protect the powerless from the powerful, the weak from the strong, to protect people from bullies. You've got judges whose only allegiance is to the truth. And sure, there are corrupt judges. There are corrupt journalists. But on the whole, the system is the best one we've got. There are checks and balances. We need to support these institutions. And the third institution that I think we need to support is science, because the scientific method, ideally, is interested only in the truth. It shies away from politics. There are corrupt scientists. We've seen just in recent times Diedrich Stoppel, Mark Hauser, two examples of people in my own field, I'm embarrassed to say, cognitive neuroscience, who fabricated data. But it caught up with them very quickly. They were kicked out of their professions. There was a third case of somebody who ended up in prison. How do you end up in prison for making up data? Well, if you spent government money doing it, that's how. So, again, not a perfect system, but I don't think you want to throw out the work of tens of thousands of scientists for, you know, four people who are bad eggs. And you don't want to say, well, the legal system is crooked because of three or four bad judges, three or four bad politicians. So when I say it's each of our individual responsibilities, what I mean is that I think all of us need to take responsibility for the news that we receive, the Facebook posts we view. So before you hit the like button or the thumbs up or forward something that you've seen, I'd like to suggest you take 45 seconds or so to ask yourself, is this really true? And how can I verify it? That's really what the book is about. It's to give you the ability to look at something and within just a short amount of time, know which questions to ask to figure out whether this makes sense or not. And don't be part of the problem of sending around a story like the 350 million, a story that could get viewed a million times as a lie, where the truth or the retraction of it or the fact check of it gets only 30,000 views as opposed to a million. Don't be part of the problem. So the idea of the book, as I say, is to save us all time, each of us, every day, in decision-making, for parents to help their kids get better grades, to help us evaluate health claims that we might read. And I'd like to give you an example of some of the kinds of things that are in the book, kinds of questions it asks you to think about. One of them is to consider plausibility. Is a claim even plausible? I took a taxi the other day. I was working in the back on my computer. I was actually writing my remarks for what I was going to say today. And the taxi driver saw me working in the back, and he said, "Oh, you've got internet, do you?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "I understand there are 15 billion people in the world who lack the internet." Now, I don't know exactly what the population of the world is. This is not one of my hobbies. The last time I looked, it was about 7 billion, not 15. And I'll allow for the possibility that the population has crept up since I looked in on it. Maybe it's crept up to 8 billion. Maybe there was a mass tragedy and we lost a few hundreds of millions. But, you know, within some margin of error, 7 billion, 7.5 billion... Not, there aren't 15 billion people. Of course, I understood there's a whole emotional side of this, too. I understood that the cab driver wasn't trying to get into a debate about numbers. The cab driver was trying to express the emotional point, I believe, that in this in a city of great prosperity and in a world where there's unequal distribution of wealth, isn't it a tragedy that so many people still don't have access to the internet, which could really help them to pull themselves up out of poverty and ignorance. He didn't say that, but perhaps that was the underlying text. So we had a very interesting and productive conversation about lack of access to the internet. I had just been at Google a few weeks earlier, where I went to Google X, the big top secret project, where I was given a tour of the balloons that they're launching over Africa, which will carry Wi-Fi signals to vast populations in Africa who don't have the internet. Interestingly, many of them have cell phones, but they don't have internet capacity. So, you know, we talked about that and how great that was. At the end, I said, by the way, You know, there are only 7 billion people in the world, not 15 billion. It doesn't undermine your concern, but you know, numbers matter. It matters because if you're going to allocate resources to a problem and you've got a bunch of problems to deal with, you want to know what the highest risk is. A lot of people die from stomach cancer. Not many people die from rarer diseases. So you might want to put the money into the disease where it will do the most good, but there's not a big public understanding that stomach cancer is a huge killer. So, I mean, the numbers matter. I want to close with just one other tip. So that's plausibility. The other tip I wanted to give is that experts are not always what they seem to be. They're... You hear a claim and you think that it's being proposed or validated by an expert, but sometimes it's worth taking a step back and thinking for just 10 or 15 seconds. Yet I'm not asking for a lot of time here. And it's time that you've saved, you know, because the internet gives you everything immediately. You don't have to trot down to the nearest library and look something up in a book anymore. So with all that trotting time you've saved, you know, you can spend a little bit of thinking time, I propose. So how many of you are familiar with the claim that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate? This was a big ad campaign in the UK and in the US as well. By the way, Colgate was sued. They had to stop making the claim. But what's wrong with the claim? Well, if you're trying to do evidence-based thinking, the first question you might ask is, who are these dentists? Who are they? Do they still have their licenses? Did Colgate pay them to say this? Are they getting free samples of Colgate? Might there be a bias? And by the way, how many dentists did they interview? Was it literally 5? And you know, 4 of them liked Colgate? Or was it 500 and you're dealing with a proportion? That makes a difference. And the reason they got sued is because what does that claim lead the average person to believe? If you're not thinking all that clearly about it, most people, according to the court anyway, according to the Crown, most people believe that it implies that 4 out of 5 dentists prefer Colgate. Not simply that they recommend it, but that they prefer it. And this is where one of Colgate's competitors got into the game and said, that's not fair, because the actual survey asked the dentists to name all the toothpastes that they recommend. And it's true, 4 out of 5 recommended Colgate, but they also recommended about 6 others. So what you're getting is what we scientists call a selective windowing of the data. They're only showing you a thin slice view out a narrow window of what really is an entire vast landscape. So you have to ask yourself, am I being shown something selectively? Is there something in the wording that might be intentionally vague or intentionally misleading? So the next time you want to distort something, I'm giving you advice, next time you want to distort something, think, is there a simple change of word I could make that will allow me to make a claim and actually fool people because they're going to think I'm making a different claim? But I'm actually interested in what I think is a more fascinating problem, which is that, is the dentist even the right person to ask about what the best toothpaste is? Now, I've been going to dentists my whole life, and I don't recall a single time. I go 3-4 times a year. I don't recall a single time. You know, this is over 200 dental visits by now. I don't recall a single time when my dentist asked me what toothpaste I use. And I don't remember my dentist asking any of the other patients what toothpaste they use. How in the world would a dentist know what the best toothpaste is? I can see the logical, well, illogical leap that most of us make. Oh, this is a claim about teeth. Dentists are teeth specialists, but they're specialists of a very particular variety. They're specialists in, you know, filling cavities and doing checkups and taking x-rays and solving bad breath problems, thankfully. Some of them are oral surgeons. What you need is a research dentist, a research specialist, somebody who is perhaps a combination scientist dentist who runs a research study, gives a bunch of different toothpaste to people at random, follows those people for several years, and see who ends up with the better oral health, right? That's what you need to have. Just asking a dentist, it's tantamount to what happened to poor Sally Clark. You may remember the young mother, it's been at least 20 years now in the UK, who was convicted of murdering her own child, went to prison for 3 years before her husband finally persuaded somebody to do an autopsy on the dead infant, which exonerated the mother. But just think about how horrible to be... First, think how horrible it is to lose a child, and then to add on to that the accusation that you did it. I mean, it's unimaginable. And it was all based on the testimony of a false expert. The Crown brought as an expert a pediatrician who testified that it was wildly unlikely that the infant had died by any other means than at the hands of its mother. And I think you see the thrust of my argument here, where I'm going with this. Is a pediatrician really an expert on how infants die? A pediatrician is an expert on when they need to be inoculated, when they reach certain developmental milestones or not, how to treat infant diseases, childhood diseases. But if you're a competent pediatrician, you could go your entire 40 years of practice and never see a dead infant. Thankfully, it's very rare. The right expert, the proper expert in a case like this, which if Sally Clark had a competent defense attorney would have known, the right expert is a medical examiner, a coroner, a forensic pediatrician, somebody who has seen hundreds of infant deaths and really specializes in that. So a lot of the problems we have, and I have to say on behalf of my field of science, not just neuroscience but science in general, a lot of the problems we have are that experts are too ready to step outside their area of expertise and pontificate about things they have no business talking about. Like the pediatrician in the Sally Ann Clark case, like the dentists in the Colgate case, they should have said, I don't know, ask somebody else. And like William Shockley, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics, great physicist, but he had disturbing and wrong racist views about blacks, believing that they were genetically inferior. He had no training in genetics or biology or anything that would allow him to form that opinion. He just felt it, and he went around the country and did a lot of damage. He set race relations back 40 or 50 years. So I think the two things here are that scientists need to not step outside their area, and the rest of us, public and scientists alike, need to stand up and cry foul. As I said, it comes back to individual responsibility. Too many people in my field say, well, yeah, I know that what that scientist is saying is wrong. It's not my job to keep him in line. That's somebody else's job. And I say that kind of thinking has to stop. Democracy requires we participate and stand up. And with that, I ask you to all stand up symbolically, and I'm grateful for your attendance. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. So, I said I read the book in bed, and actually, much to my wife's chagrin, because she is trying to get to sleep, I keep telling her fantastic things that I read and make me laugh. I love the fact that the average human being has one testicle, for example. I think that's a...
It's a problem with averages, isn't it?
Yeah, no. So it's both true and false.
If you're not careful with your averages, you end up believing some funny things.
And I spent about half an hour last night. I did get there in the end.
I mean, imagine you meet a Martian. The Martian says, "You know, I'm interested in these things that you humans have. What, on average, you know."
Yeah, exactly. But I spent about half an hour last night trying to work out why it's true, and I did work out in the end that why it's true that if 30 families have between them 90 children, that it is true, of course, that the average family size is 3. But that if you meet one child, you would have thought, therefore, that the average number of siblings they'd have is 2, but actually it could be 5 or 6. So I got there in the end. But so the book is full of very interesting stuff like that. Questions? I mean, the first one is, I mean, we're all at it, aren't we? That's really my first question. I mean, who in this room has written a CV? You know, I was at a conference this morning in the construction sector, and someone said, all this stuff about alternative facts. I said, look, I think estate agents probably got there on alternative facts a long time before Donald Trump even did. So this kind of, this partial presentation of information is something which we just do as human beings, and we have to do it as human beings. In fact, if we went around telling the truth about ourselves all the time, it would be a pretty miserable world, wouldn't it?
Well, look, there's certainly a place for lies in society. I've never told my Aunt Tilly that I didn't like her hat or that I can't stand her cooking. I value my relationship with Aunt Tilly. I'm willing to eat some bad food once in a while in order to see her. And I think that, I mean, there are clear cases when the government has to lie. The police don't call up the criminal on his cell phone and say, we're going to be there in 5 minutes. Don't go out the back door. You know, the government might lie for a national security reason, but for I think that we should hold policymakers accountable to real data.
I guess the point I'm making is that, I mean, Daniel Pink wrote a book a couple of years ago.
Right.
In which he said a huge proportion of modern jobs are really about selling. You know, in one way or another, we are all selling things to each other. You know, not necessarily goods, but we're selling brand, we're selling reputation, we're selling ourselves. And the process of selling is the process of marketing. And the process of marketing is choosing those things to put in the shop window and those things that you're going to kind of put under the counter. So I guess that's my point, which is that this representation of facts in the most benign rather than the most objective form is just what we all have to do all the time.
You know, my sister is in the selling business, Sherry Levitin, and she has this view that the best salesman doesn't sell you what the salesman wants you to have, but what you want to have. And you can get a customer for life. If you think of sales as a profession, not as just this one sale, you can get a customer for life if you establish a trust with people. Tell them the truth. Tell them the shortcomings about the product so that they're not disappointed and mad at you later. And I've had in my lifetime, I started out as a record producer in the 80s, and I had this extraordinary experience once with a salesman who sold me something and I didn't like it, and I brought it back, and he sold it to someone else for more money than I had paid for it, because they really wanted it, and he gave me the difference. I thought, wow, this guy has a customer for life. He's been honorable with me, and then he helped me to find the right thing. This is 40 years ago. I still work with him. So I think that that's a better strategy. I think bringing ethics into the sales project is not a bad thing. You don't have to lie. I think it's a bad strategy in the end. And part of the problem is that the truth is harder to dislodge than lies. I think it ultimately wins out.
So if we're looking for kind of culprits for some of this stuff, I'm particularly prone to choose economists, I have to say.
Was it President Kennedy who asked for a one-armed economist, a one-handed economist?
Because
he had this brain trust in the White House, and he asked the economist, what should I do? And they'd always say, on the one hand, you could do this, on the other hand...
but in a way, I mean, that's not the problem. Economists who say that are not the problem. The economists who are a problem are the economists who say that they have got formulae which enable them to predict the economic future and do this with great authority.
I think they're being
dishonest. And we saw this around Brexit.
You
know, we had a lot of economists in this country who said, after Brexit, in the immediate aftermath, all sorts of catastrophic things are very likely to happen, and none of them have happened. No one say they won't happen in the future, but they didn't say they'd happen in the future. They said they would happen after the vote, so immediately after the vote. So is economics particularly guilty of this habit of defining as objective fact that which is in the end based upon speculation?
If you'll allow me to get a little bit technical...
Not,
I know that
do.
I can do that here with this audience.
Yeah, but this is a very highbrow audience.
Right, I know.
Get as technical as you like.
This is about the only place I can do this. In neuroscience, and in fact more broadly in social science, we talk about some things as complex systems, right? A complex system is one where there are a lot of factors that interact with one another, and sometimes these two things interact and they cause what's called a second-order effect. My cab is late, and so I'm late here, and then everybody else is late where they're going, and so in effect, my cab caused everybody to be late, that kind of thing. In a complex system like the economy, like traffic, like the human brain, in theory, it's a deterministic system. What that means is if you could measure all of the billions of variables and how they interact with each other and build a model, you could determine what the outcome's going to be. But the fact is, there are all these things that you can't characterize in an economy. There's random processes. Somebody stubs their toe. They don't buy the car they thought they were going to buy because they don't make it to the dealership. And these things reverberate. So we talk about complex systems being deterministic, but not predictable. And I think many economists get stuck here. They have these wonderful, robust models that would work if only all of the data were measurable, but they're not. And so they've oversold the model. And this is why Danny Kahneman won the Nobel Prize. It was for teaching us that the system and the players in it are not rational.
So I wonder whether people who bemoan as it were, kind of this post-truth world, who say that people aren't interested in evidence, they aren't interested in facts, are themselves in a way guilty of one of your of a false correlation, which is to say, actually, I've seen survey evidence which asks people, do you believe in expertise and do you believe that policy should be based on facts? And actually, the figures are higher than they've ever been. So it doesn't seem as though the public out there is saying, I'm not interested in facts, I'm not interested in evidence. And indeed, in public policy, which is the world that I spend most of my time in, there's an ever greater emphasis on the use of data. So, for example, we've got a fantastic organisation in Britain called the Education Endowment Fund that does really, really good work on looking at kind of huge data sets to try to tell us what works best in education. It's had a big impact. Isn't the problem, therefore, actually not really about our trust in evidence and research? It's about our trust in authority. And it's because we've lost trust in authority figures, whether they're economists or politicians or celebrities or whatever it is, it's not the facts, it's the person who's telling us the facts that is the problem. And that actually, if we started to trust people in authority again, we would demonstrate that we were perfectly willing to be convinced by evidence.
That's a really interesting insight. I have to say, I'm not a political scientist, so I don't feel expert in that domain. I don't feel qualified to comment on it. But as a private citizen, what you say sounds exactly right. We've lost trust in our leadership. Either because the leadership has, fundamentally because they've let us down in one way or another, and the means by which they let us down is perhaps not relevant.
And ultimately, and then I can open it up, ultimately, is your advice to look for the single truth, or is your advice to recognise that there are multiple truths? I'll give you an example of this. A very good blog written yesterday by a guy called Torsten Bell, and he started off by saying that, you know, the unemployment rate in America is 5%. You know, it's very, very low. And he quoted Donald Trump, who'd said, that's nonsense, the unemployment rate is 30%. And you think, well, that's a typical example of Donald Trump being Donald Trump and just picking a figure. Actually, he said, the participation rate in America, the labour force participation rate, is very low. It's 68%. So you can perfectly legitimately argue that if only 68% of people are actually registered for work or registered as unemployed, they've just wandered off, particularly older men, they've just given up. Actually, the unemployment rate is more like 30% than 5%. So should we, when we hear facts, always understand that it depends where you're standing around this fact, how you're looking at it, and that it's best to try to understand that there are multiple truths, multiple ways of looking at fact? Or should we be searching for the kind of one core fact?
Well, I reject the very notion that there are multiple truths. I think what it comes down to here is semantics. There are different ways of defining unemployment. So you could either, and the United States government websites talk about this, as do many government websites, that they measure it in different ways. So if you're going to measure unemployment as the percentage of people who are looking for full-time work and are unable to find it at all, or is it the percentage of people who are looking for full-time work and can't find the work they want? Or is it the percentage of people looking for any work whatsoever? Or is it simply the percentage of people who aren't working? Maybe some are students, some are in school, some are retired, as you say. There is a fact, there is a truth associated with that very carefully defined proposition. But if we just use language in a sloppy way, and when you see something, you call it one thing and I call it another, that's an impediment to actually making any progress in a dialogue about how we're going to fix the system.
Great, thank you. There's a hand immediately there and here and there, so we'll take these three first.
Thank you. Jeremy Kaplan, a fellow of the Royal Society. Two words come to mind, or two expressions. One is vested interests. So if I take the Colgate example, your dentist may well be recommending it because he knows it's such a lousy product, you're going to be back on his door more regularly than the others. So, you know, I think there is a question, and that doesn't just apply to dentists, it applies to everybody using
status. You're not an anti-dentite.
No, I'm not. But I think, you know, if you look even beyond that, you know, even the recommends is maybe not the right question, because why is he recommending it? That leads to the other word then, which is consequences. And on what you've discussed and what Matthew just brought to the table, my concern is, what are the real consequences for anybody doing what they do? So you bring on TV, on the BBC, an expert, and he pontificates about what's going to happen in Brexit or the economy or whatever subject you're being, a sports expert. And if they get it wrong, and they all do, there is no league table saying how many times that person actually got it wrong. And they don't name and shame and say, we're never going to invite that guy again because he's useless. The same applies to politicians. It applies to CEOs at companies. So for me, the real question here, as it's down to people, vested interests and consequences, and how do we build a system where there are true consequences for misleading intentionally or not, but basically being a bad expert?
Yeah, I noticed that Andrew Wakefield is a reality TV star in America, despite the fact that, yeah, okay.
You were referring to facts at the beginning, as if the public can establish what the facts are. And you gave the example of the £350 million that can be spent on the NHS. Now, and that was a big campaign slogan for the people who wanted us to go out of the European Union. How can members of the public possibly know in advance if that's true or not?
Oh, we're aggregating.
Yeah. I do this in case there's a really crazy question, so you can ignore it without being rude. But they're actually very rare, so, you know, go on. Who knows, this might be the one.
This might be. First of all, can I just confess I'm an economist?
How many hands?
Are you an economist who accepts doubt?
Of course.
Good.
I'm not a clairvoyant, however. My question is actually about our responsibility as consumers. Newspaper consumption has fallen through the floor. Much of the news we get, we now, even genuine news, we get for free. And we're not, therefore, the amount of money that is available to newspapers to pay journalists properly to investigate means that quite often you read a report of a survey, which is really little more than a republication of a press release, rather than the journalist having the skills, the time, and the resource to actually question whether it's 4 out of 5 or 400 out of 500, et cetera, et cetera. So I just wonder how much you think it's basically our fault because we don't accept what Mr. Obama says, that democracy is not for free.
So is it our fault? What on earth do we do in the face of this stuff? And shouldn't there be... If you don't ever have to pay the consequences for using alternative facts, then aren't people going to just carry on doing it?
Well, I think that the three questions really are linked in a nice way, and I'd like to start with this one. What can you do? Well, the first thing is, if you see a claim written on the side of a bus, but not in a major newspaper or not followed up on by a major investigative news source, I would say it's likely that it's not true, because if it was, mainstream journalism would want to report on it. So there is a hierarchy of news sources. TMZ happened to break the story of Michael Jackson's death and Prince's death before anyone else, but it was only because they're sloppy journalists and they were willing to run with the story before there was any corroboration. There are hundreds of cases where they got things wrong. They had said that Miley Cyrus was dead, for example, and I mean just hundreds and hundreds. So I'd say play the percentages. On the consequences, I would like to see news organizations slow down and take their time before reporting a story. And we saw this just in the last few days with the Trident story here. The initial reports that came out, as far as I was able to glean, were very confused. In the old days, journalists would have spent a few days gathering data, interviewing people, and when they really had the story, they would go to their editor, and then their editor would say, nope, not ready yet, go out, talk to two more people, and then they'd publish the story. We've become too greedy, I think, in wanting to have minute-to-minute news. And the fact is, I don't think, for most of us, I mean, you're in the public sphere, you're in government, it's different for you, but for most of us, we don't need to know on a minute-by-minute basis what's happening with the Trident story or with these kinds of stories. I'd like to see on television, because we now have the technology to do it, I'd like to see fact-checkers with a scrolling bar at the bottom saying, you know, that was a lie. Let them do a tape delay of 15 seconds, right, which is enough time, right, and either put a Pinocchio nose or, in a little angel halo or something. Just a quick graphic like that, an emoticon. I was gratified to see just last week the New York Times, which is a newspaper that gets it right more often than many. They were self-critical. They did a report, and they realized they've made some errors. And as of last week, they're going to expand training for reporters and editors. They're going to hire journalists with more varied skills and with a more diverse background, and they're going to deepen engagement with their readers, which includes real-time interaction. So I think we're heading in the right direction, and I'm gratified that, at least in the U.S., the media, instead of backing down in the last week, has doubled down and are trying even harder.
Hi, George Gates, I'm a fellow. I found the word casuistry, or case-based reasoning, for justifying morally telling a lie because that's the right thing to do as opposed to the truth. And my question is, are politicians using too much paltering, which is using the truth to assert a bigger lie?
Hello, thank you very much for a very informative talk. My name is Stefan Goldstein. I know a few of us in this room are interested in the notion of information literacy, which I think is something, it's a term that has actually appeared in the blurb to describe this meeting. And we're actually quite interested to know the role that information literacy might actually play. In other words, the sort of skills and competencies and confidence that individuals need to be able to use a certain degree of discernment in the way that they access information, in the way they discover information, in the way that they interpret information. This is not something which is really taught to any extent in the school curriculum in the UK, possibly not in the US either, and possibly not in most places. Seems to me that it's actually quite an urgent priority to try to get this notion, slightly inelegant term that I admit, but this notion of information literacy or digital literacy, if you prefer to call it that, or media literacy, to turn it into something of a more mainstream issue recognised by policymakers and others. And I'd be interested to know your thoughts on this.
And then right at the back.
You talked about the journey from where we've come from, which seems to be a little bit of, we're not sure if it's true, to where we are now, which is, I'm not sure if I can even find out if it's true or not. Now, a lot of people in this room, we've taken an hour out of our day to be able to come and have this conversation, but most people can't. And so my question is this, really, which is, how do we stop facts from becoming an elitist concept, only accessible to people like these in the room?
I kind of related to that, and these are interesting, challenging questions, but there is a lot of fact-checking available now. There are lots of fact-checking sites. I suspect not that many people use them, because I suspect that part of the problem we've got is that people would rather read stuff that confirms their prejudices than challenges them.
That's certainly true. And then the way the brain functions is that when we're stressed, we take cognitive shortcuts. And this is part of an ancient evolutionary system that evolved to get us out of the way of a lion or an avalanche or something like that. So when we're stressed, as we are just simply from living today in densely packed cities, from information overload, from not being able... When's the last time any of you came home from work and felt that you had accomplished everything during the day that you had wanted to, right? We're in a state of physiological, neurological stress all the time, which gives the short-circuiting of the brain, the quick solution system, privilege. And we have to just recognize that that's what's going on, fight the tendency, and make time to deliberate, to be careful.
I talked about, years and years ago, I did a lecture, and I talked about the concept of, it's an inelegant concept, but cognitive reflexivity, by which I meant that in the modern world, we need to be more aware of our cognitive frailties, our cognitive limitations.
Yes.
And overcome them.
Yes.
And this is something that is a benefit of the modern world, because we're more aware, due to Daniel Kahneman and various other people, we're more aware of these cognitive frailties.
And you ask what we can do. We're 100 people in a room. Well, each of us knows at least 10 people, and we can tell 10 people that, you know, evidence-based decision-making actually leads to a better life for you. If you follow the simple steps that are in the book, and I tried to put all of everything that, to get to your question, I've been working on the book for 15 years, and I've been running a curriculum in critical thinking at Minerva University in San Francisco. It's 4 years of critical thinking for college students. I was part of a team, including Stephen Koslin from Harvard, who helped to design this curriculum. I think, you know, most of the things that we could think of are in the book. So, this isn't the only book that does it. I'm not trying to make that claim. There are a lot of books on critical thinking, but any of them will do. And if we just educate those around us that it's worth doing, that you'll live, you know, there's evidence, that evidence-based thinking leads to better life outcomes, better life satisfaction, longevity. For one thing, people go see the doctor more and follow the advice better. You know, all these kinds of things cohere.
Okay, I'm going to take five questions because we're running out of time. Just keep them brief, and then, Daniel, just pick two or three of them to respond to. Yep.
Well, what do we make of Sean Spicer's comments trying to actually make us believe the inauguration was kind of bigger than it actually was?
Thanks very much. So along the lines of evidence-based decision making, I practice evidence-based healthcare. I'm a doctor. And actually, often individuals come to see you say, well, you're the expert. You tell me what I should believe. And they don't want to, or maybe don't need to, or cannot evaluate the evidence. And I think that's what's happening right now, that actually people, when they read what's in the news, they're often led by opinion or somebody else's analysis, and we're losing the ability to question ourselves. And so that's another form of elitism, where there's an authority to believe, you know, certain people, whether it's politicians or doctors or whoever it might be, opinion above the truth. And that's problematic in the case of evidence.
And then a Twitter question.
Yeah, we've got a question from Roxanne.
She don't have to put on the red light.
Very good.
Indeed.
Although slightly dated.
Is fact-checking obvious lies giving too much attention? And I'm a staff member here, and I'm particularly minded of a talk that Alex Evans did here
recently.
Are you
hijacking the question?
Well, kind of,
that's
but
right.
It's related.
Yeah, fine,
it's related.
Yeah.
In that actually stories and narrative are what gets people emotive and calls to action, not facts. So is there a delicate fudge of the two?
Very good. Yep.
Hi, I'm a pensioner. So what I would ask of your book is your book a complement to the use of the thesaurus?
Of the thesaurus.
The thesaurus presents a whole list of alternative.
Okay. It's interesting. All right, Dan, you've got 30 seconds to think of the answer to that one.
Is there another word for thesaurus?
That's good. Or as my colleague John Reed said, why is there only one Monopolies Commission?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
You belong in the pun attention.
Yeah, I'm here every night. Right, go on.
Spin doctors.
I wonder when we're going to go into spin doctors.
And they're an accepted part of the political establishment. Are they liars or great communicators?
You've got like 3 or 4 minutes to pick the best of those. And if you go over time, they'll have to go back to work and they won't have time to get your book. So that's just a motivation for it.
I think that I introduced something in The Organized Mind my previous book, which is also in this book, which is the fourfold table, and it's a way that I discovered through a lot of error, trial and error, and mostly error, of presenting visually information that people have a hard time digesting when they're just in numbers. And it allows anybody, you know, anybody over the age of 10 to just fill in numbers in a table and look at the risks of certain things. And I'll just give as an example the kinds of conversations that I think doctors could be encouraged to have with their patients. If you're taking a statin, which is a cholesterol-lowering drug, there's a 1 in 300 chance that the drug will help you. So one person is helped, 299 are not helped, of the people who are taking statins. This is for one of the more largely prescribed statins. This is just a typical example of the kinds of things you'll find in the book of a way to make sense out of confusing information and numbers. Now, you might think, well, okay, I'll take the 1 in 300 chance of getting better. I'd like to lower my cholesterol, so yes. But the question you should ask is, what are the side effects? And for this particular drug, the side effects occur in 5% of the population. Well, of those 300 people who are taking it, 5% or 5 per 100, 15 people are going to experience side effects, such as debilitating muscle and joint pain, gastrointestinal distress, nausea, vomiting, a host of other things. So the way to look at it is you're 15 times more likely to be harmed by the drug than helped by it. So it doesn't mean you shouldn't take it, but the conversation you should have with your doctor is, am I in a special risk group that makes these generalized statistics not apply to me? Or am I in the generalized risk group? And you know, what would my quality of life be like if I allow myself to have heart disease, the 1 in 300 chance, or if I allow myself to have these side effects? Can I live with them? That's a more productive conversation than starting from scratch.
So imagine you had to choose between buying a book and buying a box of chocolates. And you might think, oh, I'll buy the box of chocolates because it'll be full of little treats that I can have and I can enjoy. Well, this book... I don't, you know where I'm going, don't you? You don't need to choose because it is a book which is like, reading this book is like eating a box of chocolates because you keep picking out very tasty morsels. And the difference is you can share what's in this book and you can't share. Anyway, I'm finished with that one. So thank you for your questions. I'm sorry we couldn't take more because there were lots more in the room, but it's been a fantastic session. And we have yet, I would promise you, we have only scraped about 1% of the goodies in this book. It's available outside and Daniel will sign it for you, I think. That's right. Which will increase its value by an untold proportion. So it just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking Daniel Levitin.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.